welcome to the Wonder Woman podcast, where we discuss a variety of subjects all pertaining to optimizing your physique, building strength, developing a strong mindset, and tools to help you win at life. I'm Michelle McDonald, and I'm the founder of the Wonder Woman coaching team. We are a community of results-driven coaches and clients who believe that we can age like never before. Hi, guys. Welcome back to the Wonder Woman podcast. And today, we have another incredibly special guest for you. It's Gabrielle Fundero. And I think I first started following Gabrielle a few years back when I was trying to field some questions, some great questions from my followers about sucralose. And so I was trying to find out what does the science say about artificial sweeteners, and are they bad for you? I really wanted to give a really clear science-based answer. So I ended up finding Gabrielle Fundero, and ever since then I've been following her, and I'm so glad that she's here on the show today. So Gabrielle Fundero, she has a PhD in human nutrition, foods, and exercise from Virginia Tech, first of all, and she studied the role of the gut microbiome in metabolic disease. So this is her jam. This is what she studies. This is what she's great at. She spent 4 years as an assistant professor of exercise science at George Gwinnett College. She worked for several years as a Renaissance nutrition coach. And since 2017, she's had her own telehealth coaching business, Vitamin PhD. So you can go and follow her on Instagram, Vitamin PhD. She's got a link tree where you can buy her book. It's an amazing book that she co-wrote with Jesse Hoffman called The Science of Gut Health, where she's going to really deep dive into all the things that we're going to talk about today. She also is a researcher for Examine, as well as many ongoing consulting ventures for websites and magazines like Precision Nutrition. Love those guys. Shape Magazine, Oxygen Magazine. She teaches and mentors for various international seminars, podcasts, and advisory boards. And she's currently a journalist for Barbin, which is another favorite resource that I send my clients to. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you Gabrielle Fundero.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that intro. Hopefully live up to everyone's expectations now.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. So, you know, gut health, our audience is primarily women and in the sort of 30 to 70 year old range. And gut health is on everyone's topic of discussion. Women we know tend to have more digestive issues, whether it's digesting food, dealing with that midday bloat, bowel regularity, and we're bombarded every day with, you know, cleanses and teas to take and, you know, colonics and, you know, what's the right diet for my gut health and all of that stuff. So I'm so glad that you're here to help us sift through, you know, some of the stuff that's not useful information, that is even disinformation, what the science is saying in terms of what we should do. So I'm really hoping that the audience is going to walk away with a bit more critical understanding of how to look at information coming at them from social media, and some good take homes, like what you can start to do right away to optimize your health, which is what our audience cares about is aging well and optimizing their health, their performance, their mental health, all of that. And they're very, very, I know you talk about that a lot. They're very interrelated, your gut health, your digestion, your stress, your anxiety, your well-being. So let's start off with getting like an idea of what exactly we're talking about when we talk about the gut microbiome. Can you take a stab at summing that up in a nutshell for us? Because I know it's complicated.
Absolutely. The analogy that I would give is that we're looking at an ecosystem just like we would look at an ecosystem in the ocean or a rainforest. We have identified many different species. We have a general understanding of how things function, but we don't know everything yet. And the gut microbiome is a much newer area of research than environmental science or ecology. So the gut microbiome refers to all of the microorganisms, so all of the microbes that live in your digestive tract. But in most cases, we're talking about the gut microbiome. We're really talking about the small and the large intestine. So those microbes have a lot of genetic material, just like we do. We have DNA, and our DNA determines essentially what our bodies can and will do. So when we say microbiome, we mean the microbes or microbiota plus all of their genetic material. There are about 40 trillion microbes that live in your small and large intestine with a couple hundred thousand different genes that are used by anywhere from maybe 400 to 1,000 species. We're really not sure. Even though most of the time people are talking about bacteria when they say gut microbes or gut microbiota, bacteria make up the vast majority of those microbes, but we also have archaea, which are microbes that are similar back to bacteria, but different enough. We have some fungi like yeasts. So Candida is one that probably will ring some bells for people. We also have viruses, and we have viruses that can infect our cells as well as viruses that can infect bacterial cells. And all these microbes are interacting with one another. They're all, with the exception of viruses, they're living things that are competing for real estate and for nutrients. And they also interact with our cells. So they interact with our intestinal cells. And then they also interact with the immune cells that are working just below the surface of those intestinal cells. They communicate with those pretty directly. And then through more indirect means, they can also communicate with cells that are in the periphery of our body. So adipose or fat cells, muscle cells. And they also have a connection to the brain via the gut-brain axis. So they do play a role in probably every aspect of human health and disease. But because the microbiome is so complex and it's different in every person, it's still really difficult to draw any strong correlations or relationships between the microbiome and any outcome.
Yeah, it's so huge. One of the things that got me in your book is, you know, you said there are, I think, 150 times more genetic material in the microbiome, the gut microbiome, than in the actual host, 150 times more. Yep. And it's like equivalent to two pounds of biomass?
Yes, yeah, about 2 pounds.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, you were to like scoop out all of the microbes and yeah, you'd have a...
Would that be like 2 pounds, like a 2 pounds of butter, like two blocks of butter?
Yeah, or like maybe...
Or it would be more dense.
Probably look more like stool, but
yeah. Wow. That's crazy. And it's so complicated. I mean, these are teeny, 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 tiny, things. So there's just so much genetic material. And it's important, I think, to underline that for the listeners, because it's easy to get pulled into marketing and think that we really know clearly anything about this mass. And it's like, it is complicated, right? Great. Okay. So... this is going to be a big question. Where does the gut biome come from, right? Is there microbiota in newborns? Like, can we fix our gut biome? All of these sorts of questions. So let's start with where does it come from, first of all? How do we get how do we get it?
So whether or not we have gut microbes in utero, like while we're still in the womb, is actually a contentious topic. It's unclear right now whether that's actually the case or whether some samples might have been contaminated by environmental microbes. But what we're pretty certain of is that when an infant is born, that's when they're first going to be sort of inoculated with microbes. So when a baby is born vaginally, they're going to be exposed both to the vaginal microbiome and the gut microbiome because of the proximity between the vaginal canal and the anus. So while a lot of people assume that a baby is going to primarily have a microbiome inhabited by the lactobacilli, because that's the vaginal canal, actually they are usually predominantly inhabited by bifidobacteria, which is more of the gut microbiome. Now, if a baby is born via C-section, they are actually going to be initially inhabited by more of the mother's skin microbiome and the environmental microbes. So for that reason, a baby that's born vaginally will have a microbiome that's very similar to the gut microbiome of the mother, whereas a baby that's born via C-section will look significantly different. And there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that a baby born via C-section will take a little bit longer to develop what would be considered like a normal infant microbiome, where we see a lot of those bifidobacteria and some lactobacilli. And they're starting to draw correlations between early C-section birth and later development of various allergies, especially like skin allergies. I want to put a caveat there that they had also drawn a correlation between C-section birth and developing obesity later in life. But what actually is the case there is that it's more likely for a woman with a high BMI to undergo a C-section. There's a stronger link between parental and infant or adolescent obesity, but it's probably not via the gut microbiome. But that's where it first comes from. So we're inoculated at birth. And then over the course of the next several months and years, first we are breastfed or bottle fed. That's another place where we can develop a different set of microbes. Breastfeeding provides human milk oligosaccharides. It's a very specific type of carbohydrate that can only be found in breast milk, along with things like antibodies, and that will shape the infant's microbiome. Whereas an infant that's fed with formula will not have access to those human milk oligosaccharides. They will have access to things that are pretty similar, but there are still some differences between breast and bottle feeding as well. And then there's some evidence that, again, we might see a delayed establishment of what would be considered kind of like the more stable or a normal infant microbiome, which is actually kind of less stable than we would see later in life. The next big change that we see is when we start weaning and start introducing solid foods. And now there's a much larger variety of different fiber types and microbe accessible carbohydrates that will feed the infant slash toddler's microbiome. So it's around the age of maybe three that we start to see the microbiome stabilize, and it'll look pretty similar throughout a person's life until they reach a more like of an elderly age, maybe if we're looking at like 60 or 70. Interestingly, the microbiome starts to kind of revert back to a less diverse, less stable form that we saw during those infant and toddler years.
Interesting. Okay. And then in terms of the early formulation, what about things like pets? Like, is that going to influence? It is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There is really any, and I also want to point out, so we have skin microbiome, we have an oral microbiome, women have a vaginal microbiome. There are microbes covering literally every surface. And so you are borrowing microbes from your pets, from your partner, from foods that you're eating, from things that you might come into contact in the environment. Now, that's not to say that each one of those microbes is necessarily going to take up residence in your gut, because the gut is a very specific environment. And just like any other living organism, there are some that are going to thrive in that environment and some that are not. So there's a lot of evidence that the things that we're eating, especially when we're looking at yeasts, those will be higher in our fecal samples. So what goes in will come out, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a part of the community. But it still could potentially influence the community as it passes through. I mean, one of the most common or obvious examples is we have a food-borne illness, right? We ingest a microbe that produces toxins that make us sick. Eventually, we can treat that or it'll pass through on its own. It's sort of like a self-limiting disease, but that's one really obvious example. Like, we ingest a microbe, it makes us sick. It did have an impact for a little while there. But when we look at kind of a zoomed out view of the microbiome's general shape and function, that looks like it's pretty stable in a person over the course of their lives. Like, even if they take an antibiotic, then they'll usually, or like exercise, change their dietary pattern, even without stopping those interventions, there's still usually a return back to something that looks more like the baseline.
Great. Awesome. So I'm so glad you mentioned that. So a couple things that I want to ask, what about, there's a lot of discussion about, whether or not it's good for you to be, cleaning all your surfaces and trying to eliminate exposure to all of these, minutiae, these bacteria and whatnot, if that's a good thing or if that's a bad thing. I know when I was a kid, I was, running around in dirt and eating caterpillars and just, it was crazier back then. I mean, you'd leave your kid on the floor or outside and they would get dirty and put sand in their mouth. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's topical, especially after the pandemic.
Oh, for sure. Yes. So this, that sort of belief system and like the changing tides and whether we want to be like super clean or, you know, get into the dirt, that's based on two different hypotheses. One is the hygiene hypothesis, which theorizes that our microbiomes are becoming less diverse and potentially less functional, less health supporting over time, because we are practicing so much more hygiene now. So we are removing a lot of the microbes from various surfaces. We're not being exposed to as much. Even the process of birth is much more sterile than it was at one point. So there's a theory there that because of the increased hygiene, that we might be losing some of the microbes that should normally be there. And that is based on the old friends hypothesis, which theorizes that there's a set group of microbes that we have co-evolved with since the beginning of when Homo sapiens came into existence, and that they are supposed to be there. They're sort of the keystone species that provides stability to the rest of the microbiome. And that if we lose those because of the hygiene, and because we can lose diversity from one generation to the next, you know, if the mother has less diversity, then the offspring will have less and less, that's potentially problematic as well. Now, some of this comes from a perspective that our ancestors were doing it better, that there's this sort of like they're viewed as like more noble or more like, you know, closer to the earth. And so we assumed that that was the right way to be, or that they were healthier. And when we look at populations that are more rural, more agrarian, and compare those to a westernized population, we do see that there are differences, and that they tend to have a more diverse microbiome, the individuals living in more rural, less developed areas. But what's often left out is that they also have higher rates of infectious GI disease. They usually have much higher rates of pathogenic parasite infection. So increased diversity, that does not alone tell the whole story. We also want to look at things like, okay, but what's the actual outcome? Looking at things like infant mortality rates, looking at things like infectious disease, longevity, so like the lifespan. So in a more developed country, we're going to have longer lifespans, but of course we have an increased risk of chronic diseases, like lifestyle-related diseases. Our cancer rates might be higher as well, but that could also be because we live longer. And so there's, as in our later years, then there might be a higher risk of developing various types of cancers versus a person who's going to pass away in their 30s or 40s. So there are a lot of different factors that we have to consider when we're trying to interpret what it means that these groups have higher levels of microbial diversity. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's a thing that we should shoot for. And certainly when we're looking at things like infectious diseases, one of the best modes of prevention is hygiene, like looking at water hygiene and looking at personal hygiene. And we want to wash our hands because we are really going to be exposed to so many microbes, even if we do wash our surfaces, even if we do wash our hands, that we don't really, I don't think that it's as huge of a concern that like we're completely wiping out all of the microbes that we would need to come into contact with.
Great. Yeah. And probably the questions in terms of looking for how much biodiversity do we need and how much cleanliness do we need? We're going to be looking at things like, well, we for sure need clean water, right? Like that's a must. And we for sure need to be able to, have good sanitation. We can't be running around and having exposure to that sort of thing. So there's probably those sorts of layers of questions too, to try to unpack, well, how much diversity do we need and how do we get it? And then how far are we taking hygiene? Is it too far? Something like that. But I guess that's what the scientists will be doing, creating the study and, coming up with some solutions for us. Okay, so that brings me to the next question. Antibiotics, cleanliness, etc., colonics, cleanses. Can we, if we have our if our gut microbiome comes as an adult, we kind of inherit that from our family, the surroundings, birth, things that are outside of our control. What can we do to, if we're suffering, right, from digestive issues and all of that sort of thing, things that we think might be related to the gut and our gut microbiome, and if that, and even if that's an accurate statement, can we fix it by doing a cleanse? Is there some kind of protocol that we can do? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I really recommend against any sort of cleanse or reset, detoxes. Those are actually really red flag languages, because not only do they misrepresent the complexity and stability of the microbiome and its role in potential GI distress, they can also just be harmful. I mean, a lot of times a detox is going to be some form of a laxative. And so you're going to be, you're going to maybe feel cleansed because you have diarrhea for a couple of days. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have fixed anything or that anything was broken in the first place. So one thing to note is that we haven't drawn any correlations or any like cause and even if we haven't drawn any cause and effect relationships and hardly any correlations between the gut microbiome and GI distress.
That's huge.
Yes. So if you have gas, bloating, loose bowel movements, constipation, trying to determine like whether it's your microbiome or specific microbes right now, the science is not there. And that's not going to be helpful to you. That's just, even though you can do like the comprehensive stool analysis testing, those reference ranges are set by manufacturers of those tests. Yes, based on a population that they picked from a piece of research. But when we consider that we don't have a consensus on healthy microbiome, we don't actually have a scientific consensus on reference ranges for specific microbes outside of known pathogens like Listeria or C. difficile, it's not an applicable bit of information. It's just saying that you have a different amount of this microbe compared to whomever we chose as your control group. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the wrong amount, because we don't know the right amount. So when a person is having GI distress, the best way to approach that is to first go to a gastroenterologist, rule out the possibility of a serious disease like ulcerative colitis or something like IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. And then from there, either you've identified that there's actually a disease process going on and you can treat that, or it becomes more about management via diet and lifestyle factors, because there are quite a few foods that contain carbohydrates that are highly fermentable or that attract a lot of water into the gut, and that causes GI distress. Mm-hmm. So yes, the microbiome plays a role, but it's not a causative role. So when we say something like, you know, do a reset or kill off the bad microbes, even that is a huge oversimplification, because microbes are mostly only opportunistically naughty. Like when a potential pathogen senses that it has a great enough abundance to overcome other microbes and our immune defenses, then it will start producing what we call virulence factors. It will produce the products that can make us ill. But otherwise, even C. difficile is a normal inhabitant of the gut. And when we think about something like mosquitoes are a nuisance. It would be really great if we could just get rid of mosquitoes, right? Like they're kind of bad, quote unquote. But if we were to wipe out all the mosquitoes, that would have a huge ripple effect on the rest of the ecosystem. So it's just not a thing that we know is a good idea to do, let alone something that we can actually do, because we don't have the ability to be really precise with which microbes we're knocking out. Unfortunately, it would be great if we could, because then we could make much better antibiotics.
Awesome. Okay, great. So I'm just going to recap that for everyone. So you're saying that if you're struggling a little bit with your gut health, number one, if it's something that's really interfering with your day to day, don't just do a cleanse. Those things, number one, they're not based on science. And number two, the first thing you want to do is go see a GI specialist and just check some things off the list that you want to make sure you don't have, like you're not actually in a diseased state and there's something that you actually can do about it. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is in terms terms of these cleanses and you know, getting rid of the bad gut bacteria, et cetera. There's really no science-based evidence. And this stuff's being studied, right? Like, there's a lot of money going into studying gut health. I know a lot with gut health and obesity too right now, but there's a lot of research being done, and there's just no conclusive evidence that you can target, number one, a particular bacteria, and that getting rid of it completely is even a smart idea, or that there's a real true causal effect between that and whatever, you know, indigestions or whatever that you're experiencing. Is that kind of accurate?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
So that's important, because I know women get bombarded heavily, right? I think every Christmas time there's this detox and teas, and it pains me to see people in the fitness industry slogging these teas. When I was a kid, I did the Master Cleanse. You know the Master Cleanse with the cayenne pepper and then the salt water, and oh my God. So I think I must have done that 3 times in my university career, and I can't even think of it now as a professional, right? Like, wow. But it was really popular back then. Okay, great. And then, so let's talk about how sort of fixed is your gut microbiome? Because that's the other side of the question. Again, if you feel like you got a bad rap, you inherited not the best gut, but what can you do about it?
Yeah. And I love that you said inherited, because really, like, one of the most prominent researchers and speakers in the field of gut microbiome science, Colin Hill, he has a great op-ed that's entitled, "You Have the Microbiome You've Earned." So there's a part of it that it's an inheritance. And then there's a part of it that is that you have specifically because you are a human. And so you have human specific microbes. And then you have some of your microbes are supported by or suppressed by your lifestyle factors. So you've got like genetics, you have the uncontrollable environmental factors, and then you have a dietary pattern and general lifestyle. We're thinking about like physical activity, sleep patterns. It's estimated that maybe like, 10 to 20-ish percent of your microbiome might be influenced or shapeable by your dietary pattern and lifestyle factors. And so the strongest evidence, the strongest connections that we have so far would be the influence of having a very plant-centric dietary pattern. So something like the Mediterranean dietary pattern or dietary approaches to stop hypertension, they are very generally based on whole foods that are in the form of, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, limited amounts of animal protein, and limited amounts of processed sugars or refined carbohydrates and excess sodium and whatnot. So essentially it's just kind of a minimally processed whole foods based plant rich diet that appears to reduce, compared to a westernized style diet, there's about a 20% lower risk of developing colorectal cancer, which is pretty significant.
Which is one of the most common cancers.
Yes, exactly. So that's one. And then they've also found that those dietary patterns generally are associated with more microbial diversity. Now, we don't have, again, like, more isn't necessarily better. We don't have a scale.
That's important to say.
Yeah, it's like, we don't have a scale for the right amount of diversity. But if we assume that a person who is eating a westernized style dietary pattern and is living a sedentary lifestyle is at increased risk of a number of different diseases, and we have started to identify some mechanisms that link the microbiome and its functionality to some of those disease processes, we can reasonably say, that's probably not a good idea. It's probably a better idea to eat this whole foods based plant-centric dietary pattern and engage in physical activity, because physical activity and cardiovascular fitness is another correlation to a more diverse microbiome, especially microbes that ferment carbohydrates to short-chain fatty acids, some of which play a role in things like metabolic flexibility, so being insulin sensitive, appetite regulation. So those are considered generally to be pretty beneficial. So if we want to best support our gut microbiome in its ability to do the things that it's probably supposed to do in supporting our health and normal functionality, dietary pattern and physical activity would be the absolute most important, that in my opinion, after a lot of reading and writing about it.
Great. Okay. So you're saying that even though there's not a direct causal relationship between your gut microbiome and say certain disease states, we can say by looking at a lot of the research that there's definitely an association with certain dietary patterns and a healthy or an unhealthy, state of being. So even though we don't quite understand all the mechanisms, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just trying to recap here. We can say your best bet is to have a plant rich a diet. And when we talk about, and that doesn't mean, correct me again if I'm wrong, that doesn't mean a vegetarian diet, but if you're going to be eating meat, make sure that you're eating lots of vegetables, fruits, legumes, and specifically whole grains versus just grains, refined processed grains, right?
Right. Because the refined carbohydrates are going to be primarily taken up by our own cells. And we don't want to, there's going to be a normal level of competition between what our cells will absorb and what the microbes will be able to use for energy, because they can use simple carbohydrates also. But we don't want to create so much competition that they're losing out, because they will lose out, because most of our absorption occurs in the small intestine, but most of the microbes are in our large intestine. So they really rely on the indigestible carbohydrates like dietary fibers and resistant starch that our enzymes can't break down. And so they reach the large intestine where those microbes can then use them to make energy.
Awesome. Okay. So I have another point that I want you to elucidate on. So basically, is this correct to say that we're going to roughly have about 2 pounds of biomass, and what we're trying to do is cultivate the healthiest 2 pounds of biomass that we can. And so when we're thinking about what foods we're bringing in that our cells aren't able to digest, it becomes the kind of fodder for these bacteria and whatnot, that we're specifically trying to make sure that we're maintaining that population, that diversity that's actually beneficial for us. Is that okay? Because I know some people might be like, oh my God, I want to get rid of any microbes in my body, you know, but no, there's going to be microbes in your body. So make sure you got the right ones taking up real estate.
Yeah. And we would say even that there is, it's about the variety. So the number of different species, and then also the proportions. So how many of the known or suspected beneficial versus those that are just neutral, where you don't know what they do, versus the ones that are potential pathogens. The potential pathogens are still important, because especially early in life, what's probably happening is that those potential pathogens and other microbes are interacting with our intestinal cells and our immune cells as our immune system is becoming educated on who's my own, what is my own body, what is an intruder, a potential pathogen, and then what is a kind of a good guy, or like one that we don't have to worry about. And so what can go awry there is when our immune system gets some misinformation, it gets the wrong idea about what is an intruder or a pathogen, that's when we can develop something like an autoimmune disease, when we're attacking our own cells, or we develop an allergy to something, that to a protein in a food that like is not actually problematic, but our immune system says, oh, you know, I've labeled this thing as a problem. So it's not about only having like quote unquote good or beneficial microbes. It's right. That we need to be exposed to a whole consortium.
Yeah, diversity is the key, because it's so hard to understand what's going on. And I want to bring up another point, because I read that in your book and in the talk you gave at the Wonder Woman, which is that there's also cultural and geographic differences in what would constitute like a well-functioning gut biome. So that's important, right? Because you know, like there's different bacteria taking up real estate, whether you're living in Japan versus whether you're in America. And is that regardless of the foods you're eating, or is it hand in hand with the foods you're eating?
It probably is hand in hand. Although when you put people from different geographic locations on the same dietary pattern, they still will separate by geographic location. So there's something to do with, you know, there could be genetic factors, there could be environmental factors, there could be factors that we're just not aware of at this point. And there are also, of course, that it's the factor of the microbiome itself, that microbes interact with one another. So even your response to a dietary intervention is going to be influenced by what group of microbes you started with. So since everyone has a different set, it is really hard to determine like what should be the baseline, what should be a healthy reference, because a healthy person, like you mentioned, a healthy person in Japan or China is going to look different from a healthy person in the United States or Canada. Gotcha. And we don't know, like, it's just like, what is, you know, even when we're looking at health in a non-gut microbiome sense, it's hard to define exactly what health looks like, kind of know what it's not.
I'm going to ask you that question. What does that look like? Is it like what's a healthy period? Is it, you know, how much pain is okay? How much of a bleed is okay? How much bloating is okay? You know, ultimately, do we just kind of have some broad sort of like, well, this is out of bounds. This is, now you have to we need to look at what's going on here. And then we also have to talk about the individual. Well, generally for you, health is going to look like this. And we want to, you know, kind of be aware of the diet or stress levels or whatnot if we're starting to experience symptoms outside of this health boundary. What would you say about that?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, and that's really how we assess the gut microbiome in terms of like looking at what's really, really out of bounds, which would be, do you have a really, really high level of C. difficile that's producing specific toxins that's making you ill? And now you have C. difficile associated diarrhea. But that doesn't mean that the answer is having no C. difficile. Like I mentioned, we just want to have low enough levels relative to your other microbes that it's not going to start producing those virulence factors. Or if you were to ingest a little bit of a foodborne, a microbe that causes foodborne illness, so you ingest some Listeria, maybe you don't get sick from it because it's a very small amount that you've ingested and your gut microbiome is very resilient and it is really abundant and super diverse. And so the Listeria doesn't have the ability to proliferate and overcome your defenses. And so it passes through. Whereas another person who maybe has a suppressed immune system and doesn't have as functional of a microbiome, they do become ill after eating that because that Listeria is not facing so much of a defense. It doesn't have so many opponents. So that's another thing to think about too, is that you are... it can influence the rest of your health. I mean, it can influence whether you're going to be infected by something. It can influence potentially your risk of developing another disease, but it still is going to be very individual in terms of like what is your healthy microbiome versus someone else's. And it's looking at both who's there and also what they're doing. So if we look at it like a store full of employees, if a few employees call out, it's not a huge deal because other people can step in. They're like, oh, I know how to run the cash register.
I like that analogy. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. So it's a lot like that, where like one microbe, a community, you know, a small community within the whole microbiome might be killed off. You know, we took an antibiotic or something, but if we still maintain the overall functionality because there's a lot of redundancy, other microbes just step in and do the same job, then does it matter so much whether we lost that group? I mean, that's an unanswered question. It's sort of rhetorical, but it's another way to look at like what actually matters when we're talking about having a kind of a good gut microbiome.
Okay, great. So the take home would be that, you know, how do I know if I have a healthy gut biome? And you might have to add to this. It's one, you're not having these negative outcomes like bloody stools or diarrhea, this sort of thing. And number two, in terms of having a healthy immune system, it sounds like they kind of go hand in hand. Like you're more resilient. You're not going to get, as sick as often. Maybe I'm going too far here though, but is that also like a good indication that you do have a healthy gut biome? Did I miss anything?
Yeah. I mean, it could be, but it's one of those things that, you know, if you're eating a really diverse plant-centric diet, if you're getting regular physical activity, You know, if you're practicing good hygiene in terms of you have access to clean water, you can wash your hands, probably your chances of becoming ill are lower anyway, because your immune system is up to par, because you have less exposure to infectious diseases. And also, your gut microbiome is probably going to be more diverse than a person who is not eating a lot of plants and is not active. And also, there are other factors in that person's life that will put them at greater risk of potentially developing an illness. So it's because those things cannot be controlled for that it's really difficult to determine the influence of the gut microbiome versus other factors and to try and draw a cause and effect relationship.
Recapping what you had just said about you know, how do you know if you have a healthy gut biome? And so we're talking about the absence of major, you know, things like diarrhea and blood in your stool and that sort of thing. And then also that resiliency and potentially, you know, how often are you getting sick and how badly are you getting sick? Is your immunity and the resiliency of your gut biome, is there any correlation there? Could we say anything about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's just difficult to determine what impact the microbiome is having independent of the other factors that are influencing both the microbiome and our resistance to illness. Because when we're looking at, you know, eating a plant-centric diet, getting regular physical activity, having access to clean water, practicing hygiene, all of those things can reduce the likelihood of becoming ill. And they also would very likely support a diverse gut microbiome. Whereas the opposite could be true as well, that when we're not engaging in those activities, when we don't have access to clean water and hygiene, we're more likely to become ill. And we may also have a less diverse microbiome. But we can't remove a person's microbiome and see if they get sick, or remove all of the other factors and just use the microbiome. And that's part of the reason that microbiome science is trying to use other means of analysis, and is even rethinking the point of trying to come up with a cause and effect relationship. Like, do we, because it's probably not possible, we can separate the influence of genetics fairly well. If we have one microbe of interest or a couple microbes of interest, we might be able to determine their potential influence on developing a specific disease. So one sort of exception to the rule that, like, we don't have strong relationships would be F. prausnitzii. That's one bacterial species that it might become a biomarker for colorectal cancer because there seems to be a very strong link between the two. But for the most part, what we find is that when we look at a bunch of different people with inflammatory bowel disease, for example, there are going to be some disease shared aspects or characteristics, but most of them are just human shared. It's just we're gonna have a lot of things in common just because we're human. Then we have a lot of that individual difference because of so many different factors. And we just don't have the capacity to rule everything out and say, okay, yes, this was definitely your gut microbiome. So the best thing that we can do right now is to say, well, when a person's really physically active, they tend to have higher levels of these butyrate producers. And we have a lot of this mechanistic data. We have a lot of, like, studies looking at the role of butyrate in cell culture and in rodents. And we have some findings from humans that shows that, like, people with high levels of butyrate tend to have, you know, better metabolic flexibility or something like that. So it's a lot of, like, if and then this is the outcome.
Yeah, a lot of association, which is, it's just so complex, right? I mean, it's just so complex. I mean, it sounds like it's almost more complex than unpacking the DNA strands, right? It's the genetic code. It's like way more genetic material to look at, and it's moving around in some areas. And
I mean, we mapped the human genome, and that was a huge undertaking. And that's why we can do cool stuff like, you know, 23andMe and whatnot, and, like, using, you know, DNA and forensics. But yeah, when we're looking at 150 times more genes, we haven't even identified all of the microbes that are present. And quite often what happens is when we analyze a stool sample, we'll get a bunch that have been identified and then a bunch that we just don't know what they are. Like, they are an unnamed microbial species or genus or something. It's like this group that no one has really been able to identify. They haven't been able to map the entire the gene sequence for that microbe and say like, oh, this is this microbe and it's related to all of these microbes. Like we're kind of making a family tree of the gut microbiome, but it's so massive that we have only a small portion of it complete.
Okay, so going back to some practical applications and recommendations. So one, plant-centric diet. So you can totally eat animal meat, but make sure there's an abundance of plant fibers coming in. Do you want to explain a little bit what those are? Because, I mean, I get blue in the face telling my clients to eat more vegetables and get some legumes in there. And, you know, like it's ongoing. Everyone's so macro-focused, right? Don't just be macros. Let food be your medicine. Don't forget the micros.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at fiber types, most of the microbes will preferentially use soluble fibers. So those are fibers that are water soluble. So they'll produce like a gel. They're going to be a little bit more.
I ate my oatmeal this morning.
Yes, exactly. So oatmeal is a great example. A lot of like when we're thinking of fruits and vegetables, it's going to be a lot of like, rather than the skin, it's going to be the inside portion of the fruit or the vegetable. So those are going to be where we're going to get a lot of our soluble fibers. We also get that from whole grains, from legumes. The insoluble fiber are the fiber types that, generally speaking, if you were to put them in water, they wouldn't change at all. So looking at things like lettuce, the fruit and vegetable peels. So those will help to add bulk to the stool, but they aren't used as preferentially by microbes. The microbes really like the chemical structure of soluble fibers is more accessible to them. And that's what they're going to use to produce energy for themselves.
So with those insoluble fibers, sorry to interrupt, with those insoluble fibers, they're important because they help, as you said, bulk the stool, and then this helps like pull. What exactly does that do? Is it good to have these bulky stools? Tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, within reason, you know, there's a, if we have too much bulk and not enough water, then we can develop constipation. But essentially when we have the bulk in the stool, when we have a mass that's moving through the GI tract, that stretching of the intestine actually initiates reactions in the skeletal muscle that continues to push the food through, in the smooth muscle that continues to push the food through. So it's essentially creating a bulk so that it will pass through and then we have a comfortable bowel movement at the end. Gotcha. And then the soluble fibers can draw some water into the stool that makes it a little bit easier to pass as well. So it's kind of like getting that balance. And you know, that's going to be another kind of Goldilocks thing. It depends on the person. The other reason that I recommend getting
the balance of soluble to insoluble, it depends on the person. So each individual wants to be present to that and just watch big fluctuations of plant fibers and noticing like, oh my God, I'm constipated. Did I not drink water or did I do a big shift in my food sources maybe?
Right. Yeah. And the same thing can be said for fermentable carbohydrates, that a lot of the, you know, kind of like the really popular sort of like fitness whole foods, we're looking at like avocados and whole grains and lentils and whatnot. They're really rich in prebiotics. So those are microbe accessible carbohydrates, those fibers that are used primarily by beneficial microbes. But because they're so fermentable, they can lead to a lot of gas production, a lot of bloating. So sometimes people will interpret that as there's something wrong with my gut or my microbiome. No, they're doing exactly what they're meant to be doing. But you might have to just kind of throttle the amount of those highly fermentable fibers that you're having, especially when we're looking at something like inulin. That's a functional fiber that's added to a lot of products. So a lot of vegan products and meal replacement bars will have inulin added because it's a prebiotic. And it's a functional fiber, it can improve health, but it is so highly fermentable that having a really large amount of it at once is most likely going to cause a lot of GI distress. So trying to, again, kind of like get that a wide variety, less so from supplements and more so from whole foods, because you're going to be getting it in smaller amounts throughout the day. And also, we don't know exactly which microbes like or prefer which fiber types. And when we're thinking about trying to reduce competition between the beneficial and neutral microbes, we want to provide a wide variety to say like, well, there's plenty of everything to go around. And so that's another reason why it's recommended to have a wide variety of fruits, vegetables, whole grains and all that, because that way you can just say like, well, I don't know who wants what, but here you go.
Gotcha. Okay. So we've got soluble fibers, insoluble fibers, fermentable fibers. I think those are your FODMAP foods, are they?
Yeah, so not all fat, not all fermentable fibers are going to be FODMAP. Like, well, when we talk about like high FODMAP foods, those are the ones that are highly, highly fermentable. Gotcha. And that would probably cause some GI distress.
Okay, great. So fermentable fibers. And then is there anything else that we need to touch on?
Probably people are curious about fermented foods and sort of probiotic foods.
So
fermented food is one that has had microbes added to it. And those microbes have broken down the carbohydrates and use them for energy. So something like yogurt is an example where the microbes, it becomes cultured because the microbes break down the lactose that's found in the dairy. And then we end up with yogurt, or we look at things like alcohol is another, you know, we use yeast for fermentation there. The only probiotic food, so the only food that can be considered probiotic because it has enough beneficial microbes to exert an improvement in human health, would be dairy. So fermented dairy is a probiotic food. Other fermented foods are just fermented. They're not necessarily probiotic because they haven't shown that they're able to improve human health, or that they provide enough of the beneficial microbes.
Are a lot of studies done on them? Is it just a lack of studies, or is it, nope, they've done the studies, they've tried to make a connection, and nothing's happening with your sauerkraut?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. So things like sauerkraut and—
I love kimchi.
Yeah, and kimchi. But one interesting sort of caveat, an interesting sort of issue with the research there is that in some cultures, the fermented cabbages and whatnot are eaten classically with beer, with alcohol. And so these observational studies, it's like, oh, does this actually increase your risk of gastric cancer? Or is it just that it's because these foods are eaten with, you know, alongside alcohol? In other cases, it's just that they have, the research is very limited. So things like natto, tempeh, and kombucha just don't have the research backing at this point in time to show that they improve human health. There was actually kind of a cheeky, funny little system. I think it was a systematic review or a meta-analysis on kombucha. It only included one study. That was the only study. Like that, they were just pointing out, hey, can we stop making claims about kombucha? Because there's been one study and we're really putting the cart before the horse. Yeah. Whereas, you know, fermented dairy, there's quite a large body of research supporting it.
Great. Okay. So basically what you're saying then is it's not that there's science saying that there's no link, but we just don't have science that there is a link for that stuff. But we do have a ton of great research backing fermented dairy, right? So yogurt, kefir, that sort of thing. Okay, great. All right. So another question then for you is if somebody wants, how much fiber should a woman, an average size female, be aiming for a, you know, supporting gut biome diversity? And how, and then how does she start, you know, getting herself there? Like just go and suddenly go up there right from day one, or should she, how should she get up there?
Mm-hmm. The recommendations in the US for women would be 25 grams of fiber per day.
Is that thriving or surviving?
Right. Yeah. And that's just like the RDA. But that's based on, you know, just like population studies showing that, you know, people who are eating 25 grams of fiber per day are at a lower risk of diseases and whatnot, whatever the outcomes were based on people who are having less than that. If you have more than that, that could be great. It could be that you don't, you know, it could be that you don't have any more improvements beyond 25 grams of fiber per day. I found that in most cases, people who are eating a generally like whole foods based diet usually are close to that. Although I think the average in the US is that because we're eating a lot of refined carbohydrates, we're getting about 15 to 19 grams of fiber per day. In other parts of the world, recommendations are actually based on the number of calories that you're eating. So it's 15 grams of fiber per 1000 calories. But that's you know, in most cases, it's going to get us about to 25, 30 grams of fiber per day. And if a person is eating much less than that, I mean, if they have been eating primarily refined carbohydrates, very little dietary fiber, there is definitely going to be an adjustment period when they start to increase their fiber intake. So there could be some bowel changes, there could be some gas and bloating. The general recommendation is just to increase slowly. So about 3 grams per week. So if you're starting at the average right now of, you know, 19 grams
per week or per day.
So say, well, Yeah. Yes. So you would increase it by 3 grams for a week. So
for the whole week. All right. So you go from 15 grams to 18 grams that week. And the following week, you bump it up to 21. So
yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And just see, because they have looked at populations like in the Inuits that will eat fiber sort of phasically, because there are parts of the year when they're subsisting primarily on, you know, flesh and blubber. It looks like there's about a 1 to 3 week period of adjustment when they do bring dietary fibers back into the diet. And it's just an anticipated, like, I'm going to have some GI distress for the next few weeks, and then things stabilize again.
Okay. So then what should a woman be thinking about in terms of, like, let's say most of the audience is going to want to, after this call, they're like, okay, I've got to improve my biodiversity here. What about the kinds of fibers, right? So should she be tracking not just her total amount of fiber, like I'm having 15 grams and 20% of it's soluble, and where do you want it to be optimally, or can we even talk about that?
Yeah, I would say that that might be a little bit cumbersome for people to try and track both soluble and insoluble. It certainly would be available on, you know, some nutrition facts labels, but aiming for just a wide variety of fruits and vegetables when you're eating the, when possible, and you're eating the flesh and the skin, then you're getting that combination of soluble and insoluble. If people find that they're very, very sensitive to increasing dietary fiber, or they're starting very low, one way would be to approach from starting with kind of lower fermentable carbohydrate content. So starting by increasing citrus fruits, lettuces, things like zucchini and cucumbers, because those are going to have a little bit more of the soluble fiber, insoluble fiber, but less of the soluble. If that feels good, then increasing to other things that have, a little bit more of a blend. Kiwis would be one example. Then, you know, if you're doing well with that, probably the foods that are going to be most likely to cause gas and bloating would be things like beans, which is obvious. A lot of people talk about that, and cruciferous vegetables. So like broccoli, cauliflower. Some people are very sensitive to fructans that are found in wheat. So those foods, if you find that, like, you're getting really, really bloated on those, that's probably what's going on. And you might need to just either increase more gradually, or have foods that are a little bit lower in the really highly fermentable carbohydrates.
What about taking a supplement like Beano, and what about cooking methods? Can you touch on that at all?
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh, cooking methods is a whole area of research for the microbiome. So that does have an impact. Cooking can both reduce the fermentable carbohydrate load, especially if you're doing something like boiling the food. And it can just make things a little bit more digestible, so that can also reduce your likelihood of gas and bloating. The enzymes, so dietary enzymes, most of them are minimally effective at best, or they're going to work in maybe like half of people. So the Beano, I want to say that's beta-galactosidase. That has been studied in a few different intervention trials, and they did find about 50% of people seem to feel better when they took Beano with their cruciferous vegetables and beans, and the other 50% didn't. Lactase is another one that helps with the lactose sugar that's found in dairy products, that it does seem to help in some cases, but not all of them. And so it's probably depends on, you know, your personal microbiome, and then the amount that you're eating versus the number of, you know, pills that you're taking. So it's worth trying. But I would say that, like, it's probably, you're going to be more successful just kind of throttling the amount that you're eating and maybe adding some of those digestive enzymes. But the others that are sold in, like, kind of like proprietary blends, and they've got like bromelain and papain, those don't have the evidence supporting that they improve gut health or digestion.
Great. Okay. So maybe some cooking methods there. Beano might be worth trying if you're struggling, for sure, smaller amounts, and then kind of increasing slowly depending on how your digestion is. And also probably just keeping a food log in. Okay, lentils are okay. I tried 40 grams of lentils in my diet today, no problem. Let's try garbanzo beans, because they're quite different, even though it seems like a bean's a bean, but a garbanzo is different than a lentil, which is different than a turtle bean.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that's a great comparison, because garbanzo beans are lower FODMAP versus lentils. So, and then also if they're canned, that's the other thing that I recommend. If you're going to go with beans, actually do use a canned bean, because they're going to lose a lot of the FODMAP content into the water. You rinse them really well, and then they're going to be more readily digestible and probably cause a little bit less gas and bloating versus having them just that you've like soaked at home and cooked from that.
Great. And so I think one of the take homes then too is you know, bringing things up slowly, getting a nice variety, keeping track of what you can comfortably have and what you can't, but also knowing that there's going to be an adjustment period. And so don't throw the baby out, or don't throw the beans out with the bean juice. Like try it again, maybe a little bit less, or try a different variety. I think too, some of the gals, I don't know if you have this available on your link tree. I know you studied the Monash dietary system, right? Which is a FODMAP elimination diet. And I want to underscore that the recommendation with FODMAP is you don't do it forever. It's just a temporary diet just to figure out what's going on. But having that variety in your diet and making sure that you're bringing things up slowly is key. Is there anything else you'd add on that in terms of getting that diversity of fibers into your diet for women?
I think that covers it. I mean, really, and aiming for that rather than trying to add a fiber supplement, because that again is where you're going to end up with a huge amount of just one type of fiber. That can definitely cause GI distress. And even though, yeah, we know like inulin is prebiotic, that's all well and good, but we want to be feeding more than just one group of microbes. And we want to be doing that in a way that's not going to cause us a lot of GI distress. And so, you know, just increasing, and it's, I think it's also just much more cost effective to go for foods rather than supplements. Although supplements,
and we're not just talking about fibers too. I mean, with vegetables and fruits, we're talking about the micronutrients, the antioxidants. Like there's that whole other world of complexity, and we don't really know a lot yet. And it's just, there's so much interfacing. It's so hard to study. I mean, you have to have metabolic wards and long study cohorts, and who's going to sign up for that? And where's the funding going to come from to eat? You know, ultimately, you're going to tell somebody, because we know you're going to tell them to eat more vegetables. Well, who's funding that? Not companies, not the farmers, right? So where's the money coming from for that? What else? Animal protein. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because of course we're really about being muscle centric at TWW. We don't want gals getting sarcopenia. I know that Brad Schoenfeld mentioned that there's some newer recent study. He kind of retracted what he used to say, which is animal protein trumps plant protein. I think you mentioned a little bit in your book that, yeah, there's some new studies saying that plant protein is actually really, really great. You talk, I think, was it pea protein you're talking about, and a protein from a fungi, right?
Yeah, mycoprotein. Yeah, which is interesting when you think about like mycoprotein. That's from fungi, so it's like not plants. Kind of, I mean, it's an animal.
It's a
I guess.
Weird, yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of funny to think of that. But yeah, so this is a contentious topic in you know, gut health and gut microbiome.
How much animal protein is safe or not safe, but like talk a little bit about that and plant-based proteins and stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So I think where a lot of the kind of like the stigmatization of animal proteins comes from in this area is that there is a link between certain metabolites that come from protein breakdown and colorectal cancer. And then there's also a link between one and cardiovascular disease. So we're looking at p-cresol comes from the breakdown of amino acids by microbes, and that is linked to colorectal cancer. And then TMAO is the one that's linked to cardiovascular disease. Now the issue with TMAO is that we can produce that even if we're breaking down protein from fish. And we know that fish is not linked to cardiovascular disease. And we know that, yes, even though red meat in context can increase our risk of, especially like cooked charred red meat can increase the risk of developing colorectal cancer later in life, that's not just a straightforward direct cause and effect relationship where like if you eat red meat at all, then you're increasing your risk of colorectal cancer. What actually is likely more important, and there's some research on this, but not a lot, is the ratio of protein to fiber in your diet, or animal protein to dietary fiber. What we want to do is provide more than enough dietary fiber so that microbes are fermenting that and they're not having to rely on what we call proteolytic fermentation, where they're breaking down those amino acids from proteins. That's where we end up producing those metabolites. It's going to happen to some extent, but the idea is that we're buffering that by having plenty of dietary fiber. So microbes want to break down the carbohydrates. You really don't prefer to produce energy from amino acids. They will if they have to, if there's nothing else available. Mm-hmm. And they will also break down the carbohydrates that are in our protective intestinal mucus lining. And that's not ideal either. So we want to provide those dietary carbohydrates to them.
And that sort of breaking down of mucus, that would come from, like, if you were doing long fasts, like fasting for a long time, or?
Theoretically, yeah. They've looked at it with ketogenic diets that don't provide really any dietary fiber. But the theory is that we have these mucin degrading microbes. Akkermansia mucinophilia is one example of a microbe that we generally think is a good guy. But if you starve the microbiome of carbohydrates, then it will start breaking down that intestinal mucus layer. And that's not a great thing, but this is a living organism. It needs nutrients. It's going to use whatever's available.
And I guess when you break down that mucus lining, you're getting a human tissue closer to exposure to bacteria. Inflammatory disease and stuff. Okay.
So that's why, and then when we look at risk of developing colorectal cancer, like when we compare vegans versus vegetarians versus omnivores, there's really no clear advantage. There may be some advantage to a vegan diet for one specific area of colorectal cancer. But again, that's looking at, you know, if we're looking at just an observational study, that's not super, super strong evidence. And we have to keep in mind, you know, that we still need it to be a prudent dietary pattern. You could eat a vegan diet and not get
still
a lot
be
of
refined
dietary.
And
yeah, like Oreos are vegan. And I'm not like eating on Oreos. They have their place. But just an example of a vegan food that doesn't provide microbe accessible carbohydrates. So as long as we're eating a prudent dietary pattern, that means that we're limiting our red meat, where usually our animal products are going to come in the forms of like fish and poultry. But that with adequate dietary fiber is just as reasonable as vegetarian or vegan.
Great. So that's a really, really great take home. So hitting those, you know, that 25 grams of fiber, getting some great diversity in terms of your sources, the, you know, soluble, insoluble, fermentable fibers, bringing your fibers up slowly if they've been on the lower side, and making sure that your protein sources are from a variety of protein sources. So not just red meat. And it's important because, again, you'll get exposed on social media from doctors and researchers that are saying it's all red meat and you can eat your liver, and it's like, you know, it's so fascinating. I've been in health for such a long time, and I know you have, and you just see the gamut and, you know, the research, and where do they find these doctors and PhDs to say these things? It's awful, right? Because the public just want answers. They're trying to be healthy. Can you just help us out, right? Don't confuse us more.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What about a plant-based proteins? Can we touch on that? So they're good, right? Like if I want to build muscle, can I tell my client, listen, you don't have to have red meat. You can still build muscle. If you want to do more plant-based protein, let's go for it. Is that safe to, or does it do I have to qualify that at all? Like what kind of plant protein, or do they need to supplement with like leucine, that sort of thing?
Right. When we're eating just 100%, if we're eating a vegan diet and it's just plant-based proteins, then there's some evidence that you might need to eat a little bit more. Your recommendations might be about 10% higher to account for the lower bioavailability. So like the lower digestibility. But as long as you're eating a variety of different plant-based proteins, you're still getting the variety and amount of the essential amino acids that you need to build muscle. So it would be a problem. I mean, and this would be a problem in any case, but like if your only plant-based protein is coming from lentils or garbanzo beans or only from soy protein, then you might end up in a place where over time you're lacking one or more of those essential amino acids that your body can't make. But just ensuring that you're getting that wide variety and maybe, you know, a little bit more than you would if you were eating an omnivorous diet, then yeah, that is still just as effective. And then, yeah, the microprotein, is a protein that it that comes from fungi. That might still be considered like too animal to some people, if, you know, if they're concerned about eating animal products, but it's another option. Some of those are also made with egg white protein to kind of like help stick everything together. So it's just something to keep in mind if you're looking at a microprotein and you want to make sure that it's completely vegan, that some of them aren't, but that's also just as effective.
Nutrient timing. Mm-hmm. For athletes, you talk about that in your book, and all of our gals are in the gym lifting weights. Some of them are on a diet and they're doing lots of cardio. You want to talk a little bit about what I think here the tables turn. So now we don't want to have our salads and our lentils pre and post workout. Don't have the you know, hummus when you're in the middle of a hard set of squats. Can you talk a little bit about nutrient timing and what kind of carb sources people should be looking at and how much fat they should be eating and that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And this isn't going to necessarily apply to everyone. Some people they have like an iron gut. They can eat whatever, whenever. So Dean Karnazes, he's an ultra endurance runner and he will eat an entire pizza while he's running because he'll be running for like 10 hours straight. You know, he has trained his
gut. So unique.
Yep. Yes. Yep. But if especially when we're looking at endurance training, or really intense resistance training, sometimes people do have pretty severe GI distress. We call that exercise-induced gastrointestinal syndrome. So it's abdominal pain, cramping, really loose bowel movements.
And we're talking like a 3-hour run or something like that, or can it be even shorter?
It could be shorter. Yeah, it could be shorter. It just really depends on the person. So if you get like runner's trot, so you're like after the end of your run, your stomach really hurts, you're having cramps, and like you have to have a bowel movement right away. Yeah. So sometimes those people will actually need to, as you mentioned, remove the dietary fiber and fat sources from their pre-workout meal. And that pre-workout meal is going to be refined carbohydrates and protein, because those are going to be digested much more quickly. And we're not going to have a lot of refuse in the GI tract. We're not going to have contents that are going to attract even more water into the intestinal tract and cause that loose bowel movement later on. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is that if a person is doing an endurance event or going for a training session that's going to be pretty long, like more than an hour, and it's hot and humid, then having a sport beverage, something like Gatorade, where we're having the correct concentration of sugar to water, that's really quickly
and
absorbed. Yes. And electrolytes as well. Yeah. Then that's going to be helpful as well, but that could also help to reduce some of the GI distress later. And even some of the markers of intestinal damage that we see after a really intense bout of endurance training, we're essentially like jostling our intestines for 3 hours. We are shunting blood away from the intestines to the muscles. So we see changes in pH, we see changes in oxygen content, and all of those things can lead to kind of like short-term markers of intestinal damage. But it's the same, you know, we can say the same thing for muscle as well. Like that's something that we'll recover later on. And it doesn't necessarily cause GI distress, but it's just something to keep in mind that, you know, if we want to think about supporting recovery of our intestinal tract, as well as our skeletal muscle, obviously nutrients are going to make a difference.
Perfect. That's something that we do actually at TWW is we actually do macros per meal. We're crazy because it's a lot of work, but we're trying to educate like what, you know, take somebody that doesn't know what a balanced meal. And so we educate them, well, this is what a good balanced meal would look like. And here's some food lists. And we have the pre and post. We prioritize easy to digest starch. So that's things that for you personally don't cause bloating. They don't take forever to digest. The fat comes down and then we'll really load up on the vegetables and a little bit higher fat in the other meals. And I could talk to you for hours and hours. So I apologize for keeping you for so long. I guess, gosh, if there's one last thing. So we talked briefly in the beginning about, you know, kind of red flags. And if you are having digestive issues, you want to consult, you know, a GI specialist, get some tests done, and then start going through, you know, food lists and looking at things like that. So we covered that in brief. And I think people can go to, what are some webinars that you offer that if somebody is suffering from more GI issues and wants to deep dive a little bit, do you offer that in your webinar stack?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, so I cover gluten-related diseases with Dr. Hardy. Dr. Hoffman and I talk about the diet culture overlap into the gut health area. I talk about the issues of trying to establish correlation and causation with the gut and various diseases. There's one on colorectal cancer as well. So there are a number of different
talks. What about IBS? Do you have a webinar on IBS?
I'm trying to think. I don't remember if we covered IBS, but it does come up though. And there are,
yes, I thought I remembered some literature there. Yeah.
And we do talk about kind of the red flags and the pseudoscience in the episode that I am on with Dr. Hoffman.
Great. So I'm going to make sure to link your link tree in the comments. And so the last thing I want to touch base on is the impact of stress and why it's so important. Why when somebody says you really got to manage your stress, it's not a negotiable. Like if we could stop thinking about that as a negotiable and really be serious about it, like I think it would solve so many problems in the modern culture because we would start to make hard decisions about our lives. Could you talk a little bit about stress and its impact on gut health?
That is an area that is still so new. I can't give a lot of information, but okay. We do have a strong evidence, obviously, that there is a link between the gut and the brain. So that gut-brain axis is primarily connected via the vagus nerve. So that's the biggest nerve that puts out parasympathetic nervous system activity. So that's the rest and digest branch of the autonomic nervous system. There's a link between mood disorders and GI disorders. So about 50% of individuals with a mood disorder will also have IBS. And there is also a correlation between psychological stress and GI symptoms. So there is definitely a relationship there. And even anecdotally, I think a lot of people say like when they're super stressed, maybe they feel nauseous or they have like nervous poops or whatever it is. So, and when we think about like evolutionarily, during our times of when our sympathetic nervous system is activated, we're super stressed, we're trying to escape a predator or something, or even during exercise, we shunt blood away from the GI tract. We bias more toward sending blood to the muscles, and the digestive process slows down. And this is why people who are exercising at high levels of intensity are more likely to have more GI distress, especially if they've had too big of a meal, because their digestive tract is not breaking things down and absorbing them. And if we have a lot of contents in the actual intestines, it attracts a lot of water. So, but when we think about stress and its effect on health, like maybe via the gut, you know, if a person is living with chronic stress, they probably are not making time for a whole foods-based plant-centric diet, physical activity, maybe their sleep is suffering. There's some evidence that the gut microbiome follows a circadian rhythm. So we are supposed to be fasting during nighttime hours, and there are going to be microbes that die off and others that thrive during that period of time, and then the opposite during daylight hours when we're sort of supposed to be eating. So like thinking about it in those terms, then stress probably has far reaching effects on all aspects of health, some of which could be via the gut microbiome. But at the moment, all we have are just these links. And unfortunately, the interventions that have been studied, like probiotics for mood disorders, are again lacking a consensus because they seem to work in some cases and not others. And the microbiome influences how drugs affect us. So they can play a role in how drugs for Parkinson's, how effective those are, the effects of chemo drugs, really any kind of drug that we're taking orally, that they're involved in the metabolism. So again, there's a link there, but the best we can say is for a lot of reasons, it's important to emphasize stress management.
Gotcha. All right. And then it's a very new science. So we're just waiting to see what they can actually prove. And so to be prudent, eat your vegetables, exercise, get your sleep, and stay on top of your stress. There are so many more questions I could ask. I'm probably going to have to beg you to come back for another episode. And we can dive a little bit deeper into more things. Gabriel, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with our audience. I really, really appreciate your time. And guys, if you want to read more about the gut health, you can look at Gabriel's book, The Science Behind Gut Health. And again, via her Linktree, a lot of other great webinars and information, and also available for coaching, right? For I don't know how much availability you have, but that's also another option to explore. So thank you again.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
Take care, everybody.
The Wonder Women Podcast is proudly sponsored and produced by Social Fix. Social Fix is a transformational digital agency specializing in digital marketing, web design, social media, video, and podcast production for fitness, beauty, health, and wellness brands. Visit socialfix.com and request a free consultation for your brand's online image.